Because
the guy,
it wasn't because the guy sat in a lotus position in a cave.
That's right. And
enjoyed his leisure. It was because he was driven.
I agree with you. You know, I agree with you saying, and I actually don't think it's necessarily in contradiction to what Karen was saying or what I was saying. I have another caller on the airwaves here.
I'll listen in, and thank you for letting me call in.
Oh, okay.
Thank
Whoops,
you.
I think she just stepped off. Okay, sorry about that. Sarah, if you want to call in again, the number is 464-8295. Again, that's 464-8295. Well, we're getting towards the end of the show. We've got about 5 minutes left, so if you have any ideas about what we're talking about here in terms of the solution of where we're headed as a country, please call in. So anyway, I want to continue a little bit more on this editorial by Bill here, and he's talking about the celebration of the Bill of Rights, which I think probably would have been more proper to have a dirge. I don't think we have much of the Bill of Rights, and becoming less so. I'm very concerned of what the Homeland Security Act and the Patriot Act are doing to the Bill of Rights. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. You have that article on one side of the Sentinel editorial, and then on the other side is the big article by Nat Hentoff. It says, "Say hello to the eye that never sleeps." He's talking about the Total Information Awareness Department, Poindexter, and so forth. They've given them several million dollars. They're creating a centralized database on all Americans. He said, Total Information Awareness Programs will scoop up medical records, telephone calls, pay-per-view, movies that you order, prescriptions, purchases, travel reservations, passport applications, records of divorces, court appearances, and practically any piece of electronically recorded information about you. Is that the kind of society you want to live? I consider that when you have a government that knows everything about you, we're getting very close to the Orwellian 1984 that he talked about. And this whole article is talking about the death of the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and so forth. So I think the juxtaposition between these two articles was interesting. Again, if anyone wants to call in and give us an update on how that Bill of Rights parade and celebration went, let us know, 464-8295. I'm kind of curious because I just wondered what the general tone of the marchers and the speakers and so forth. I think the Bill of Rights are wonderful. They could be a blueprint for actually changing this country again. If we actually had a real honest goodness Bill of Rights that was honored by the government, Thomas Jefferson said, bind people down from the mischief with the chains of the Constitution. I think the Constitution and the Bill of Rights would actually offer a solution to all the ills that plague us. But what's going on is government has pretty much thumbed its nose at the Constitution and especially the Bill of Rights. And so the Bill of Rights is very strongly jeopardized. We are still relatively free. We're having shows like this. We're able to talk, and I think that is a ray of hope to actually change things. But when they start coming down, which may be in the near, not too distant future, there are actually movements out there to jump on talk radio, and they're caught talking about, you know, in the old days, the so-called balance program, which basically boiled down to the fact that you couldn't ever say anything that was critical of government, because by attacking government, you're attacking the Bill of Rights and Constitution. Total contradiction, totally against what the Constitution and Bill of Rights is all about. All right, well, we're getting towards the end of the show here. Let's see. Paul, we just got seconds here, if you have something to say.
Hello?
Yes, Paul, we just have just seconds.
Okay, I just thought you could do a program on something very similar to the Bill of Rights, and it's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, put out by the United Nations in 1948. And it's a wonderful article, and I'm going to bring one to you, and I think you'll really enjoy seeing
Thank
it.
Thank you, Paul.
There's a little more than 10 on the rights, Article 30. Well, goes up to 30.
You know about the so-called Declaration
we want
of
more
Human Rights.
Rights.
Mm-hmm.
tell them kids you're right, they can do things at least.
I told them, I'm going to be out of town, actually.
Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask that you hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line, Mary Culbraith. We're going to be talking about what's happened to our children and what's happening to our children in the schools today. And, of course, there's much has come up as far as the new federal educational programs, which are designed to dumb down our children. We're not going to teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic. We're going to teach them about environmentalism and hugging trees and how they really have to respect the diversity and of others and accept homosexuality as being normal and be dedicated to this one-world government and embrace socialism. That's really what the test that the government's going to put out. That's the way our children will be taught now. And, of course, the schools don't go along with that. Of course, your child will not be able to get a decent rating or ever get into a decent school anywhere in the country. They have been working for many, many years to dumb down our children because they really didn't want them to understand how to read. And, of course, this goes back to the time of John Dewey at the beginning of the 20th century. And John Dewey knew that the programs we had for reading worked, and they worked very well. Phonics was a very successful program. Certainly at the beginning of the 1800s, we had a 95% literacy rate. Today we have almost 100 million people who are partially or totally illiterate, and it's been happened intentionally. And if they could get away with that, what else have they been able to get away with? Well, Myrna Culbraith has been working teaching children to read phonetically for many years, and she has developed a number of different programs. One was the phonics game, and more recently, a Phonopoly, which is a program which in 16 to 20 hours can reverse all the harm that has been done intentionally to your children, your grandchildren in government schools. Myrna, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm delighted to be with you, Dr. Stan. I think we could take as our topic for tonight how the Grinch stole reading, because, you know, there really was a Grinch when you get right down to it. I mean, John Dewey, otherwise known as Grinch, really, you know, the Grinch, how could anybody hate Christmas, right? But he did. And how could any educator hate reading? But Dewey fundamentally did. He thought it would not be compatible with his program, which essentially was to create socialism in America. And, you know, if you want to do that, then you probably do not want people who are too well able to read and criticize and understand and be, and you know, there is a deep conflict between people who have believed in the individual mind and the individual certainty of that mind, going way back to, let's say, to the days of Aristotle and Plato. Plato wanted to lie to people for their own good to create what he considered an ideal state. He laid out pretty much the pattern for totalitarianism and for socialism 3,000 years ago or nearly. And Aristotle, on the other hand, who of course was Plato's student at one time or another, Aristotle didn't believe in that. He believed in the individual mind. He believed in the survival of the individual. When people came to take Socrates and kill him for his views, Socrates went along with it and cheerfully drank the hemlock, saying he vowed to support the laws of Athens. When they were going to do the same thing to Aristotle, Aristotle got the heck out of there and lived out the rest of his life saying, I refuse to let them sin against philosophy twice. And if you follow the trend of those ideas down through the ages, you'll find everywhere that Plato's ideas triumphed, we've got socialism, communism, Nazism even is another form of it, and generalized misery, and a disregard for the individual mind. And if you go the other way down the path of Aristotle's ideas, you find the ideas that led to the American Revolution. So these things are deeply embedded, and you wouldn't think they would affect a subject like how do you teach reading or do you teach reading, but they did. What we have to recognize, most people are out there thinking, and let's speak really to parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and people for themselves who have been hurt by this. As you know, this wrong method of teaching reading goes back very heavily for over 70 years. The Run, Jane, Run books, the OO Look, Look stuff, which is all intended to teach reading by memorizing whole words, which means it's intended not to teach reading, because fundamentally you can't learn it that way. All you can learn is a certain amount of word guessing. And, you know, many people are very bright, so they nonetheless memorize a lot of words. They got pretty good at guessing. And they are survivors, you know. They're out there doing good jobs. Even I've had nuclear designers in our face-to-face courses. A nuclear designer, a lead designer, or maybe even the lead designer of the San Onofre nuclear plant came in. He said, you know, I could make the drawings for my design team better than anybody else could make them. And I would make them, but I don't make them because I can't. I have my assistant make them, he said, and I hope I catch his mistakes. And I said, you know, I hope so too. I don't live that far from San Onofre. But he literally couldn't do it. He said, I can't spell to label the drawings. So I have my assistant make them. And with any luck, I can just copy the labels.
And I think that people really don't understand that the phonics and being able to read phonetically and being able to spell phonetically go together. And because our homeschoolers are taught phonics in most homeschool, in fact, all homeschool programs I know of, that's why they do so well in the spelling bees, and that's why the children who go to government schools do so poorly. It was designed that way. In other words, if you can't take a word apart and cut it down into syllables and know the various rules that go with the pronunciation, you're certainly not going to be able to spell those words either.
That's
and
right.
So they've really dumbed down our children intentionally and maliciously. It was really an attack on the very heart of our nation. It was financed by the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie. And if you don't believe that, you really need to get the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence. I read it 40 years ago, and it changed my life because suddenly I became aware of the fact that these people of great wealth, the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Carnegies, the people who created these foundations had an agenda, and that was to dumb down our children and push socialism. And why would people of great wealth want socialism? That is the question that people have asked through the years. And of course, it soon became apparent because under a socialist society, the government controls everything. But of course, in our form of government, you have our so-called elected politicians who pass the laws. But they're all susceptible to being bribed, and many of them, of course, can't get reelected without massive infusions of money from this corporation or that corporation or this person of great wealth. And of course, once you've taken money from somebody, you're subservient to them. And as we often have said, in Washington, D.C. today, We have the finest politicians that money can buy. In fact, tomorrow, Thursday evening, we'll be having John Loeffler on the program. And John was talking to Congressman Ron Paul this last week. And Congressman Paul said, you know, there's almost nobody back here in the legislature who believes in the Constitution, who believes in much of anything. Everybody's here. They know the system is corrupt. They know the system is broken. And they just want to get all they can before they leave. Now, Congressman Paul has given up a good, successful medical practice to be back there representing us. And he is our source of information. But it's very disheartening to realize that most of your congressmen will not stand up for the oath that they've taken, that they will sworn to uphold the Constitution, and they refuse to do anything at all that doesn't benefit them personally. We have so little idealism, so much greed back in Washington, D.C. today. And really what we need to do is get people who do believe in our Constitution. The tragedy is most Americans don't even understand that document, and we're really sort of excited that we know up there in the Spokane area they're going to be setting up new programs there to teach the people the Constitution, and from there we hope it'll spread all across Oregon and Idaho and certainly the state of Washington, and we can begin to get people to understand what America was and how we lost it. But, of course, so much of this gets right back to reading. If young people can't read, they can't spell, they can't pronounce words, and we've deliberately dumbed them down by a program that was designed to fail and introduced into our schools and kept there by the radical left, who really doesn't want an educated population. They want a subservient population. Would you agree with that, Myrna?
Pretty much. One of the things that has happened, and you know how the Grinch keeps stealing reading all these years, is Dewey's philosophy and the progressives generally around Dewey, they became education. They didn't just take it over, they became the whole educational establishment. His and his allies, graduate students went out and they became professors of education, the deans of education, the superintendents of schools, the miscellaneous functions in the school system, and they also founded the teachers' unions and the National Education Association. The National Education Association, long ago when Dewey went to Russia in 1928 or thereabouts, he came back and this, by the way, was after it was already abundantly clear, if it ever was not clear, that the Russian Revolution was a totalitarian revolution. It was abundantly clear by the late 1920s. Stalin was killing people. It was 20 million kulaks had been starved to death. It was a huge, horrendous, violent, vicious mess. And Dewey came back with not one word of criticism of the Soviet Union or of Soviet education. In fact, he wrote three very favorable articles about Soviet education, etc., and they were published in, guess where, the National Education Association House Journal. The National Education Association published years ago, decades ago, a whole agenda which said, we will become the leading political force, the dominant political force, the controlling political force in America. They set out to do it, and they have done it. Some of the independent studies show that, for example, in the Al Gore campaign of the last go-round, the National Education Association and the AFT, the two teachers' unions, made the decisions, had veto power over the decisions of the Democratic Party in that entire election. So if you wonder how this is institutionalized and maintained, there is a political apparatus, various kinds of political apparatus, but that maintains it out there. And one of the things that's so terrible about it is it creeps into the culture then, and parents and grandparents and so forth that we're talking to now may not even fully realize what's going on here. They may think, because it seems now to be the case that, oh, it's tough to teach reading. There are some people that are just naturally going to fail to learn reading. There are people that are dyslexic. There are people that just naturally can't spell. There are people that, you know, on and on and on. There are people that have ADHD or ADD, and they'll never make it, and they need to be drugged with Ritalin or other forms of stimulant drugs, or the new drug that comes out now that says it's not a stimulant, but it'll fix Ritalin anyway. all of those things. As when I was guest hosting on your program, we had Dr. Peter Bragan on for one of my guests that I invited. He's the leading psychiatrist who is an expert on the adverse effects of the various kinds of psychiatric drugs, including and especially Ritalin and related drugs that are inflicted on children. All of these things, we think, we've begun to think, because it's been hammered at us with the press and with the educators and so on, that it's a terrible, awful task to teach reading, and some people are just naturally going to fail, and a certain percentage of people are going to learn to read anyway, and that'll be nice, but fundamentally a lot of people are going to fail. Well, that is absolutely not the case if you teach phonics. And if you have a kid anywhere in school, I mean, it's a pretty good idea, Dr. Stan, as you say, to get them out of there if you can. But a lot of people don't think that they have that option. They might think again and realize that they could homeschool, or they could get somebody out into a private school or a Christian school or wherever kind of school, at least to get them out of that whole pretty dangerous now area. I mean, the schools are getting increasingly dangerous. You're in increasing danger in the schools of being told your kid has ADD and he's got to go on Ritalin or else he can't go to school, or else they may even stick the social services department on you to try to take that kid away from you. So there are some pretty scary hazards out there. But people often feel disempowered because they don't know how to go about doing anything else. Now, even if you can't take a kid out of school, you need it for the just care and custody kinds of functions during the day when you work or whatever you think, whatever you believe is best, or you think, gee, the public school system used to be a pretty great thing, and maybe it's not right to take them out away from the same kind of peers that they'll be functioning with later in the world and so forth. A lot of people have that view about public education.
I think that's a misconception. It's sort of like saying, well, I'm going to send this young man out into battle in the battlefield, and he doesn't need any training. We'll just send him right out there because, after all, he's going to have to fight sooner or later. Might as well fight now. And, you know, you never would send anybody into a battlefield without thorough training. And
yeah,
if we're sending our children into the government schools where they're going to be under peer pressure to use drugs and get involved in sexual promiscuity, and the government schools are designed to destroy their love of God and family and country, and what child can stand up to the teacher who can talk circles around him and defend his faith?
Yeah,
and of course,
scary.
Right.
It's pretty scary out there. And the most scary thing of all is, you know, let's get right down to it. The brain is set up to learn reading exactly by phonics. Now, for whatever reason, well, there is a reason. You know, the brain is basically hardwired for speech. We learned that a long time ago. The human species has been speaking for a long time. It's got the brain all nicely set up for speaking. Reading is a very recent invention in those terms. It only goes back about 5,000 years in any form, and the first form of it was picture writing, and in effect, developed picture writing became hieroglyphics, and it was essentially one picture stands for one word, although eventually even hieroglyphics moved toward phonics. But when it was mainly picture language, it took 20 years in a temple school to even partly learn to read and write hieroglyphics, and you had to be one of maybe the top one out of 100, even the top one out of 1,000 to even attempt it. And you went and checked into a temple school and you gave your life to learning to read and write. That was tough. We've gone back to teaching English as if it were hieroglyphics or as if it were Chinese, where you don't have the idea of an alphabet. The great breakthrough that mankind made not very long ago, only about 3,000 years ago, was the invention of the alphabet. And somebody, and we even know pretty much who it was the Phoenicians or people in the general area of Phoenicia, what would now be called Israel, and they started to say, hey, you know, we need to send ships all over the world. We don't need to send a dockhand to temple school for 20 years to learn to read and write. We need even to be able to check off a bill of lading, write an invoice, etc. We need to do it today. And they somehow figured out a way. Somehow they realized that while there are a whole lot of words and a whole lot of different ideas, thousands of them at the least, and in English we have 1 million words, but they somehow realized that there are not very many different simple sounds that make up those words. You can break them down into one sound at a time, and you can take some of these little symbols that they were using for hieroglyphics, in effect, and they took one that looked kind of like an ox head, like a V with a crossbar, and they said, never mind letting it be the ox head, let it be our word for ox, Aleph, and let it be the ah sound. And we turned it, after a while they turned it outside, then they turned it upside down, it got to be our letter A. And they took another one that was more or less two little boxes on top of each other, it was their word for house, bet. They said, never mind, let it be house, let it be the b sound. And that's where we got our Aleph bet, our alphabet. It took a couple stages, actually. The Phoenicians had mainly consonants. The Greeks added the vowels. Pretty soon, we had a workable alphabet. What it stands for is it turns written words into talking words. And we already know how to talk, thank you very much. Even a little kid knows how to talk very well. And if you just give that kid the tools, namely, there are only 40 sounds in the whole English language, and a handful of rules, because occasionally we let a letter stand for a couple sounds and we have a rule. When you see this letter next to this one, say that. And if you learn those handful of rules, man, you are in business. In Phonopoly, in the very first game, there are 26 letters in the alphabet, and there are 4 more combinations that we use almost like letters of the alphabet, the C, H, S, H, W, H, and T, H. T, H makes a couple sounds, one that's a little harder, the, and one that's a little more just earth, and those, all together, those make 31 sounds in the very first game of Phonopoly. You learn and use and clean up if you're a little bit off on them, which most people are, 31 out of the 40 sounds. You learn what we call the short vowel sounds, which are like A for A, F for E, I for I, etc., and you clean those up if you never knew them quite properly, and there's a tape that you hear these on. If you play the first 5 or 6 minutes of the tape, it tells you how to play the game. You could be a non-reader. You could jump into Phonopoly and play it. The first game is simple, but it's very important. By the second game, it's the most important rule about vowels. How do you know when A sounds like ah or like A? And how can you tell? Or when E sounds like eh or really says its name, E, there's a rule. Usually it takes 2 to tango, sort of, on that. It 2 vowels, and the second one is silent, and the first one says its name, and they're close together. And you see how that works exactly in the second game. By the third game, it's things that commonly bright adults never even heard about. They're little rules of phonics. They're simple once anybody will point them out to you. But if somebody were to ask you, how does this letter work, the chances are that you wouldn't know it, and I know you wouldn't know it because there's one little rule, for example, that I went around asking people. At first I thought some will know it, some will not, but it's a pretty interesting rule, and not everybody knows it because I didn't know it, so I had to figure out how to teach this. So I would ask people, do you know or could you figure out how this letter would work? And this is a rule that is in about 1 out of every 4, 1 out of every 5 English words, so it's in probably 250,000 words. And I found over the years, almost nobody knew it. For many years, I got a total of 3 answers to that question. One was my writing partner that I now write Phonicsopoly with, and we write, among other things, Star Trek books. And one was Gene Roddenberry. I hung it on Gene one time when he came to give a pep talk to a class we were giving in Los Angeles Police Department in this phonics method. And they were having trouble recruiting minorities. 2/3 of male minorities flunked the beginning reading test. The 1/3 that passed, they figured, is still only on a 3rd, 4th, 5th grade level because the test was 7th grade level. You had to get half right to pass. So we were taking a group of those guys, and that kind of candidate had been failing the police academy, more than half of them. They got into the police academy, failed because of the reading. And so they gave us a chance to take some of those guys for just the mornings of 1 week, the week before they went the academy. And Gene Roddenberry came in, bless his heart, to give a pep talk to that group on our behalf. He liked what we were doing. He was interested. He even brought his investment. In
I think that listeners have to know that he was a police officer, but actually he came up with Star Trek, didn't he?
He developed, he invented it, he pitched it. In fact, he tells a funny story about how he first pitched Star Trek to one of the networks, to CBS. He had come up with it, and he wanted to make it seem simple and user-friendly and so forth, because he knew it was a big step for somebody to try to produce a science fiction series. And so he was pitching it, this is simple stuff. This is just Wagon Train to the Stars, you know. We got a few regulars in the cast, and we got a spaceship instead of the horses and so forth, but it's just human stories, and it's fine. And, by the way, I even know how we can handle the special effects, et cetera. So he's in pitching this to CBS for a long time, for hours. And they're nodding and agreeing, and they're taking notes, and he thinks he's selling it, and he's having the best time, and he figures they're takers. They've got it. And one of the things he's emphasizing is how they can do the special effects on a budget, which is a very tough technical question, and one that he had given a lot of thought and a lot of research and activity to. And so they're nodding, agreeing, and then he got to the end of the presentation. They said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Roddenberry, and we've taken very careful notes of your ideas of how to do special effects on a budget, but, we've got a series that we're going to do ourselves. It's called Lost in Space." So he had, in effect, given away the store on his technical how to do special effects, and they didn't buy the series. But luckily, somebody else did, and even then they had a tough time. They produced a whole pilot for Star Trek. It was the most expensive pilot ever shot, and it had a whole different crew than the one we're familiar with, but it became a part of a two-part episode in Star Trek. Star Trek fans would recognize Captain Pike, and when the Enterprise had to go rescue Captain Pike from a planet where everybody was ruled by illusion, a little bit like your intro to this show. And but that was originally the cast of the series, and Spock was like third or fourth in command, and a woman was second in command, a woman who later became Gene Roddenberry's wife and who became Nurse Chapel in the later series, and so on. Anyway, they finally produced this most expensive pilot, and it was rejected by the network, not because it was too bad, but because they said it was too good for television. It was too smart. It was too cerebral. People wouldn't understand it. And then this was being produced with Gene now by Desilu Studios under Lucille Ball. And they finally gambled, and they made a second pilot. And Gene cast Bill Shatner as the captain. He sort of turned Spock, who in the first episode had emotions, into the woman second in command, who was number one in the first pilot, and she was supposed to have no emotions. So he said later he gave Spock the no emotions thing, and he married number one, and that fixed that up. But yeah, you know, Gene fought very hard for the integrity of Star Trek. He almost lost Star Trek several times when he would not go along with something that the network thought was essential, and he took a stand, and luckily somebody had the brains to yield to that stand, and it became what it became.
Well, it's certainly one of the great and most successful of the video programs, television programs of all time. Well, of course, but you were telling us now about these young men, these minorities. You were teaching them how to actually read using. Were they using Phonopoly, or were you using?
Yeah, it was that particular time. It was the precursor, even before the phonics game. It was essentially like the phonics game. But by the way, it's the very same thing that you would learn and do in Phonopoly, in what is essential in this. One of the things that's very essential is, in the first couple of games, they're very simple, but they're very important because you break the words down one sound at a time, even if you know the word. Doesn't matter, especially if you know the word. And yet, typically, most adults would know the words in those first couple of games. But what you don't know is your brain is trying to jump at those and process them like a visual pattern. What you want to get it to do is process them one sound at a time, because, among other things, it appears, not only does it teach you to read, let's say you're a really non-reader or a poor reader, yes, it will teach you to read and to read extremely well, and in a few hours' time, you will read high school and college material and you won't think a thing about it, even if you were one of the 1 out of 5 adults who really, really can't read, or one of the 1 out of 2 adults, 49%, read on a fifth grade level or below, which is pretty horrifying. Think about it. That means they can't read a newspaper, they can't read text on a computer, they really can't function in this society, although they do. They, you know, they do their best, and they rely on a wife or a girlfriend or a whomever to try to spell for them sometimes, and they muddle along. They do the best they can. They may even wind up as a nuclear engineer, but still struggling.
But they can actually learn simply with a simple phonics program, and that's really what's so amazing about this. It took a long time to come up with a program that would be as bad as the one we have. We'll be right back with Myrna here in just 3 minutes. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you out in the listening audience to help us as we try to reach out across America 5 hours a day to let people understand that America is under attack. I'm certainly what we're seeing today is the orchestrated effort to dumb down our people to the point where they simply go along with whatever the government wants. They simply accept all the new rules and regulations because they don't understand our Constitution or our way of life, and most of them really would really be incapable of reading the Federalist Papers that were actually written for sixth grade students back in 1787 and 1788. People with the fifth or sixth grade education could read those and understand them, and many of our college graduates can't read the Federalist Papers today. And you see, America has been under attack, but people don't understand this. They don't understand that this is part of a generalized program. Why? Because, of course, America was a Christian nation, and the dark spiritual forces that were here from almost the beginning have always been intent upon destroying the Christian foundation of this country, and they've done a pretty good job of it. They've infiltrated our seminaries, they've infiltrated our universities, they've infiltrated our government, and they certainly control our media and our banking system. We're in real trouble today, ladies and gentlemen. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you really should think of it. And then, of course, as far as the reading is concerned, if you'd like more information on phonicsopoly or phonopoly, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and you can learn more about this amazing, amazing program, which within a relatively few hours, 16 to 20 hours, can teach a child who really cannot read or reads the second or third grade level, how to read actually going up to college level. And children who've done this, who've taken this, even adults who've actually taken this program, they've been able to improve their reading skills phenomenally, and going from the bottom a quarter of the population up to the top quarter of the population, even many of them to the college level. So this is an excellent program that's called a Phonopoly, and of course it's a board game. It's actually 5 board games, 2 bonus games, and a couple of books there to help you understand that what has happened has not happened by accident. It's happened as part of a program. America is under attack today. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, of course, we'd be glad to send it to you. Just give us a call. If you'd like our September newsletter, it tells you what happened on September 11th. Our October newsletter, of course, is Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, testimony which was blocked out by the media. Our November newsletter begins to take you into an understanding of what's happening as far as the financial markets today, and of course what happened to other great civilizations who embraced a fiat money system similar to the one that we're embracing today in America. So again, our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Myrna Culbraith. And, of course, if you're out there across America and you'd like to give us a call, you have a question or comment, maybe you don't believe this, maybe you think that what's happened to our schools and our education, that just sort of happened for no reason at all. Or maybe you are concerned. Maybe you have a reading problem yourself. There's nobody who knows more about reading than Myrna. She's been teaching phonetic reading for well over 20 years. I won't tell you how long, but this has been her life. She does an excellent job. And she has all of these rules. There are only 12 rules to the English language, 40 sounds to the English language, and children can learn these, adults can learn them. And once you understand the rules, for instance, you take the word mat, M-A-T, and you put an E on the end of it, and it becomes an mate, and the A changes from an ma to an eight. And of course, these are the sort of the rules you're going to learn if you get into a phonetic reading, and you begin to understand that there's very little that's strange about the language. It's all really very logical, but you have to know when an A is an AA and when an A is an AA. And the same thing is true for the different sounds of all of our vowels. And once you understand the rules, it's just very, very simple. The tragedy is they're not teaching you the rules, and many adults today cannot read because of a diabolical program to dumb down the people of our once great Christian nation. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Myrna, you know, of course, as you have been working with this, is the current administration going to do anything? Are they just going to talk a good game about No Child Left Behind? And then, of course, institute a federal testing for programs, not testing reading, writing, arithmetic, but really testing attitudes. What's the Bush administration doing about the crisis that they promised that they would solve?
Question, Dr. Stan. I do believe that Bush believes in phonics and in reading and in trying to get standards that will encourage reading. I think he personally does. One of the reasons I think that is a good friend of mine who is a real phonics advocate wrote a good part of the reading part of that No Child Left Behind bill, and I know that he is sincere about wanting to teach phonics. However, they're also having to couch it, and I've been back and forth to Washington about four times, as you know, talking to various levels of the Department of Education or other parts of the administration. And by the way, the week after Bush was inaugurated, he called my friend, who is a real advocate of phonics, into the White House to talk about phonics and reading and getting reading implemented. However, that doesn't mean that things are happening in a vacuum. The other side is still there. The other side had to be courted to a certain extent to pass that education bill. And while it has its good points, and particularly in the reading, it says use the research-based evidence. And the research-based evidence they're pointing to is the National Panel on Reading Report, which was commissioned by Congress to go out and find out what works in teaching reading. And it came back, guess what, and said, systematic phonics is essential. They named a couple of other points, something called phonemic awareness, which is just basically awareness that there are sounds and words, and you can break them down into one sound after another, etc. And they're making probably a bigger deal of that than it should be. And they mentioned vocabulary, and mentioned a couple of other things, and reading out loud with some feedback for comprehension, which is already built into Phonopoly, incidentally. Everything that they advocated in that report is already built into Phonopoly and my other methods to some degree. And so the research-based evidence is really there. They looked at more than 100,000 studies. They narrowed them down to the ones that had the best scientific method, the same kind of science that you would use to prove any other conclusion in social science. They came to the conclusion systematic phonics is essential. So that's the research they're pointing to. However, they also threw a bone to the whole language people saying, oh, well, of course, use good literature. Well, you know, literature doesn't belong to whole language, but they act as if it did. And so they're using that as, I mean, the opposition, the bad guys, are using that as a way to say, oh, well, we've got to have the best of both worlds, and we've got to have a balance, and we've got to have this and that. And that what they mean is, and you have to think about this, if you had a tank of clean water and a tank of poison water, they're saying put them together to make a balance. No, the whole language method really is poison, and it is incompatible with the brain. Incidentally, among the the people who were on that national panel on reading. One of them was Dr. Sally Shaywitz, whom I had as a guest when I guest hosted on your program several weeks ago. And she's a researcher from Yale who's been investigating reading and dyslexia, et cetera, for 20-something years, and now they've gotten to the point where they have brain scans where they can look inside the brain to see what is going on, and what they are seeing is, in a word, the brain reads by phonics. It reads one sound at a time when it's reading correctly. And when it's not reading correctly, it's scrambling around, the circuits look very bad, but when it's reading correctly, it's reading one sound at a time, it's reading with the language area of the brain. And you know, Dr. Stan, we've talked here and there, wait, to finish about the bill and the No Child Left Behind, while I think some of that is well intended, it had to go through the mill of the opposition. It got, vouchers had to be thrown out at the very early stage, which Bush had wanted, but he didn't get it. A number of other things that he wanted, he didn't get. He got some funding for various programs that he thought would be helpful, but it now has a joker in the deck, that is, it imposes certain penalties on schools that slip below a certain standard, but then it lets the states set that standard because, you know, perhaps for a decent reason, namely they didn't want too much federal control. But now it's had, and this has been reported in the New York Times, now it is having the pernicious effect of the states take a look at that and say, whoops, we're going to lose funding if too many of our schools fall below the standards. Well, we'd better lower the standards so that the schools don't fall below them. And they have been doing this systematically.
But of course, the other thing is that these standards really have nothing to do with reading. These standards, if you look at them, have to do with teaching us about the glories of the the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and how terrible our Bill of Rights is. And when they tell the children about the Bill of Rights, they tell them about the First Amendment, but they never tell them about the Fifth, Tenth, or Second Amendment. And these are the, and this is the testing that we're doing. Very little of the testing, I think maybe 30%, at most 40%, has to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic. The rest of it is all attitudes. That's what this testing is about, and the average person doesn't understand that the federal government is not interested in leaving our children, teaching our children the fundamentals of education. They want to change their attitude and change their beliefs. That's what the federal testing is really all about. And the fact that most people don't know that, they've never analyzed the tests. And we have a wonderful book called Fed Ed, written by Alan Quist, who's read all of these books and read the books that are put out by the people who came up with the federal tests. And these are, of course, the radical left has come up with a test. And why would a conservative president be using tests put out by the radical left aimed at destroying belief in our country and getting these children to embrace socialism, internationalism, and environmentalism, and atheism? Why would they use the federal testing and federal dollars to force that on our students? I just don't understand.
Well, I think that Bush thinks that the testing that he's asking for is testing of reading and writing and arithmetic.
But that's not what the most of the test has nothing to do with reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Yeah,
and if he doesn't know that, Ted, backed the Kennedy bill. This was Ted Kennedy's bill. And certainly Ted Kennedy's a very smart politician. Why would a conservative president back Ted Kennedy's bill?
Well, I think he struck a camp of compromise with the Kennedy camp. And, you know, I'm not holding out a brief necessarily for the administration, but I think that there is some genuine effort in the area of Bush wanting to make things better. I don't know that he's totally getting the job done. And when you talk about what they generally call standards-based education, it's perfectly true that the standards tend to be, have you got the right attitude, not do you have the information, and, you know, right attitude being defined in various ways that you've talked about, more changing their attitudes towards socialism, et cetera. Or, you know, they may not call it socialism, but they do call it being concerned with diversity. Some of the standards-based education is you never take a test, and a test never means anything, but they build up a portfolio of your work, and that portfolio had better show that you're interested in diversity and you're this and that. And it is pretty grim out there. It was really really tough and difficult. However, I think the thing that a parent has to focus on, and never mind even a parent, even an adult for themselves, who's been exposed to the wrong method of teaching reading, you don't fully know who your kids are, you don't know who you are, until you have played something like Monopoly. For example, just on a very simple level, an awful lot of adults get sleepy or tired or bored or bugged or antsy when they read. And they think, well, that's just my personality. That's just how I am about reading. That's just me. Well, no, that's you. You know, it's like, you remember the commercials that said this is your brain on drugs? Well, this is your brain on the wrong method of teaching reading. And what it does, fundamentally, is set you up to have to try to recognize a word as a visual picture. That's probably sending it to the wrong half of the brain, to the visual half of the brain, which is, turns out to be the right half. Also turns the right half does not even speak English, doesn't speak language, doesn't know what a word is. So now you're busy trying to read with the half of your brain that can't even talk. And then they wonder why you've got a problem. And then it feels to you like it's a huge effort, and it is, because I'm going to try to recognize a word on one side, go over to the other side to figure out what it means, back to the right to get the next word, back to the left. First thing they ever learned about the brain is that language is on the left side of the brain. So now you're going back and forth, and of course it makes you tired. It even sounds like it would make you tired. And what people don't know is that can change. I have seen it change in front of my eyes. And I was pretty surprised, I have to tell you, the first time it happened. I've told you once or twice, Dr. Stan, the story about the dentist-turned-attorney who came in to our face-to-face seminars. And he said, you know, my spelling's lousy. I guess I could live with that. He went back to law school in his late 50s, passed the law school, passed the bar, all set to practice as an attorney. Said his spelling is lousy, even his handwriting so bad he can't even read it. But figured he could live with all of that, but he said, well, no, what's killing me is I had to get that law degree reading 5 minutes at a time and getting up, having to walk around pounding myself on the back to try to wake up. If I try to read at night, it's just hopeless. Daytime isn't that much better. Could you do anything about that? Because this sleepy, tired stuff is killing me. Well, I didn't know then, so I said that. And I said, it'll certainly help your spelling, your comprehension. You might as well take the weekend seminar. So he did. And Dan, he just played the first two games, same first two games you would find in Phonixopoly. And one of the key things there, and if you get Phonixopoly, do this, sound it out one sound at a time, no matter how well you know the words, because doing that, the left side of the brain likes to break things down one element at a time and put them back together. If you make it and get it to do that, it will suddenly realize, and there's other research that shows whichever half of the brain thinks it's supposed to be doing a job will jump in and do that job, whether it can do it or not, whether it's any good at it, even if it's lousy at it. So if the right half of your brain has been taught to think it's supposed to be doing the job of reading, and it has probably, it's going to try to do it, it's going to hold on to it for dear life until you give it a little nudge and you give the left side of the brain enough ammunition by doing that one sound at a time thing that it seizes the job and says, hey, let me take care of this. And then you may get just an amazing brain shift. And the reason I know how amazing it is, this dentist turned attorney is not the only one, but he came in, he played just the first two games. If he'd gotten to the third one, I would have been a little less surprised, because there's really interesting zinger rules, one that Gene Roddenberry had never even heard the question about. I'll tell you more about that when we get a chance. But anyway, very interesting rules in the third game. He didn't get that far. He only got the first two games, which are mainly breaking it down one sound at a time and that main rule about vowels that you were just explaining. And he went home. Well, he thought, I better get back for the seminar tomorrow with a good night's sleep. I'll just read for 5 minutes. It'll knock me right out. Because a lot of people say that he's reading like a sleeping pill. And he, you know, he couldn't read for 5 minutes at night, 3 minutes at night. He picked up a book confidently expecting to fall asleep. Not only did he not fall asleep, but he could not put the cotton picking book down. And he came in telling this story, and he said, I might have to prop my eyes open with toothpicks today, but I sure kept them open last night for the first time in my life. He read all night long, And you could not have seen a happier human being. Well, I've since told that story to a lot of people, including some radio audiences and television and so on. And by the way, lately I've been talking for one reason or another to some people who were listening to me on various radio programs and who called in to order Phenopoly, and the operators were busy or something, and I called them back myself. And a lot of them, and I'm speaking to people in your audience too, a lot of them were grandparents. They said, yeah, you know, I've got some grandkids. I'd like to get it for the grandkids. But who I'm really getting it for is myself, because you told that story about the sleepy tire. Well, I told it about the attorney. I told it about a talk show host who got over his sleepy tires while he was teaching his 10-year-old to read, and they all of a sudden discovered that his 3-year-old, who'd been hanging around at the edges of the games, also could read. A truck pulled up beside him, and a big moving truck, and she looked out the window from her little car seat and read, Mayflower, and he suddenly almost went off the road, realizing his 3-year-old could read from our method. Well, I told that story to a few people, and especially the sleepy, tired story. And he got, by the way, while he was doing that, he, the talk show host, got over his own version of sleepy, tired. You know, he could read, but he got tired or bored, or he put it, read a few pages and put it aside. It's not only the problem, Stan, of the worst-case people who really can't read, or the medium-case people who can't read on a fifth-grade level. It's the people who are the best and the brightest who, yes, they read and they function and they're doing pretty well, but their spelling is probably not so hot. They probably don't like reading very much, or they may not read for pleasure. They just read what they absolutely have to do. If we're talking to those people in your audience tonight, boy, I would suggest that they run, do not walk. Call you and get Phenopoly.
Well, let's go to Kurt, who's calling in here. Hi, Kurt. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, kind of both. I was talking to an official up in Sacramento in the Department of Education. We can't mention his name because of the content here. And he told me, and he's very much pro-phonics. We've known each other for years. He told me that the current law is that in California we have to have phonics in the schools, but the problem is that the teachers are completely unqualified to teach it. What do you know about that?
Well, that's true, too, and this was reported in that National Panel on Reading report and further reported, therefore, in the USA Today, and they said only 10% of teachers, grade school teachers, even claim, in effect, to know how to teach phonics. Only 10%, they said, know how to teach phonics. In my experience, even the ones who think they know how to teach phonics know maybe 10, 15, 20, 30% of what they ought to know, or, you know, maybe 10% of what's in Phenopoly. But even the ones who are trying and who want to, yes, they do not really know. And if you're a teacher out there and you're in charge of minds somewhere along the system, whether you're in grade school, high school, I don't care, get Phenopoly, lock your door if you have to. Don't tell anybody. Just it's supplemental materials. It's a game. It amuses the kids. It doesn't have anything to do with how we teach reading. Just play the game. Then you will have, even in your high school classes, many, many kids literally cannot read or cannot even begin to read the text you're talking about. You don't have to be an expert to use Phenopoly to do this. And by the way, for example, in our study under a U.S. Department of Education grant, independent third-party study, we took some ordinary teachers, 4 of them. 2 were young, 2 were old, and some of the older ones were advocates of phonics, but they knew 10% of what they needed to know. They were astounded by what we introduced them to in Phenopoly. And the young ones were not any better. They were just out of teacher's college. They hadn't learned how to teach phonics. Not one of those people should have been anywhere near a kid learning to read, except we taught them very briefly with Phenopoly, just a few hours, just kind of, here's how you play the game. And they turned around and they taught very briefly some high school age aides who came in and they sat down between the teachers and the aides. They sat down and played Phenopoly with the kids. These were third to sixth grade kids, in worst case, bottom 25% of their class, bottom 25% on a nationally standardized test of reading. They played this just 30, 40 minutes at a time after school a few times a week for less than 4 weeks. And they went from the bottom 25% to the top 14% in the country. These were disadvantaged kids, poor kids, three-quarters of them were Hispanic, all the reasons why you can't read, right? And these were not well-qualified public school teachers either, but they had the tool. And once they saw it, they were entranced with Monopoly, and they wanted it, and they couldn't believe the results they were getting. They were just in shock. I went out to visit the program one day, and the teachers were saying, gee, they seem to be getting it. They love it. They're just crazed about it, and they seem to be getting it, but I just wonder if they could really read something now. They'd only been about three games into it. And so I pulled out a newspaper, and I saw one kid that he was a Hispanic kid, but I could see he was interested in all of this. So I just picked him sort of at random, and I said, Jose, would you read this for me? And he read the newspaper, and these teachers practically fell on the floor. I mean, they were doing it, but they didn't know quite how successful they were yet. And it's that. They're not qualified, and there is a lot of resistance amongst them because they feel, and it is the law in California, you're supposed to teach phonics, but it has not been implemented, or a little bit here and there, but not really, because there is a huge resistance on the part of the teachers union and many professional organizations out there. A lot of individual teachers are pretty nice people.
But of course, part of this is, of course, that I'm sure some teachers don't understand. Some teachers have been told it doesn't work, but there are some people who really want to keep our people dumbed down. Anything else you want to say, Kurt?
Yes, I think one of the best things that members of your audience can do are to get two books and read them in order. They were written about 25, 28 years apart by Rudy Flesch. One is Why Johnny Can't Read. The other one is Why Johnny Still Can't Read. And he answers the arguments, which are paper tigers, and he's really good at it.
He really is.
I would certainly endorse that. Rudolf Flesch is one of the great men of all time, and he's the one who blew the whistle on this sight reading, whole word method of teaching reading decades ago, and I am a great admirer of Flesch.
And of course, the thing is, Kurt, that some people know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the parents to know, because why, they'd be furious. So they would get their kids out of government schools, and then, of course, they wouldn't be able to control their heart, mind, and soul. Anything else you want to say, Kurt? We're just about out of time.
I think my third grade teacher read Rudy Flesch's first book way back in 53 or 55.
And they taught you phonics, yeah?
And we learned phonics in third grade.
Well, you were lucky.
Very thankful.
God bless you. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Well, we're just about out of time. Ernie, are you there?
Yeah, sure.
All right, we're just going to have to let you go. We're going to have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the Great Northwest. Thanks so much. We'll be talking to you off the air.
Thank you. Love you.
Bye-bye. Hey, you too. And this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time, of course, that we bid adieu to our listeners. And in the Great Northwest, that's Eastern Washington, Western Idaho, Northeastern Oregon, but we appreciate the opportunity to be on with you there on the American Christian Network, and of course our other listeners across the nation. Why you can continue listening to us on the internet for this evening's program. And so we simply ask our listeners who are going to be leaving us to pray for America, to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, God is going to turn his back on America forever. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes. We're going to have with us an old friend. His name is Rodney Stitz. And Rodney, of course, was with the FAA for many years. First of all, he was a pilot, and he flew all over the world of commercial airlines in the Second World War, a commercial airline pilot. Then he worked to work for FAA for many, many years, and certainly during that time, he had the opportunity to investigate many airline crashes. And, of course, he found out that one of the major airlines in the United Airlines was not really keeping up in its maintenance and training, and that's why there were some major, terrible, terrible crashes, but they were all covered up by the officials in the FAA. They didn't want to rock the boat. And, of course, you could be sure that there were people in key positions in government who were certainly on United Airlines payroll, or they, maybe they wanted to go to work for United Airlines when they got out of the FAA, left government service, and they could go to work for United Airlines for maybe 10 years before they retired, and then ended up with two very lucrative, jobs, and so two lucrative pensions. So this, unfortunately, is the way the world really works. Well, Chris Rodney kept trying to bring out the facts about these crashes, and I shall have to admit that the tragedy is that the FAA didn't want to hear this when, of course, he couldn't get the FAA to do anything about it, and it is a criminal offense to know that a crime has been committed and not to report it, so he reported it to the federal federal judges in the San Francisco area, and of course they didn't want to hear it either. In other words, they didn't want any of this information out, and of course eventually because he kept resubmitting new requests all the time to have these cases heard, why eventually he was sent off to prison. What was his crime? Why he was trying to bring out the fact that the FAA was not doing its job. Well, of course, we're going to be with you in just a moment here, and hopefully we'll have Rodney Stitz with us. And Rodney, of course, is going to be talking this evening about his impression of what happened on 9-1-1. And we'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dr. Stan, and we've got Rodney Stitz. Hi, Rodney. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm in a blackout area, but I don't have to do any reading.
All right, fine. Well, of course, when did you lose your power?
Oh, about an hour and a half ago.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you can be on with us anyway. Well, we were talking earlier in the day when we spoke. Of course, you were looking upon what happened on September 11th of last year, really as an airline disaster, as much as a terrorist attack, and you were pointing out there's certainly certain FAA rules. Now, you were a flyer for many, many years. You worked for the FAA for many years. You know, of course, what happens when a plane is hijacked. What ordinarily happens? What instructions are given by the FAA, the people who know a plane is hijacked? Don't they almost immediately notify the military so there'd be fighter planes up there?
Well, best answer to that I can give is no, because first of all, no one was authorized to shoot down a plane full of people because someone on the ground thinks it may have been hijacked, and maybe it was, and maybe it'll crash into a building. So it's a little difficult to understand how we can deliberately kill 300 to 400 men, women, and children on a possibility. But with our new administration, of course, that's just one of the things that is being done.
Well, of course, the thing that has always mystified me, they knew that there was going to be an attack on America. They knew that the terrorists were planning on hijacking our planes, and actually, of course, it even talked about crashing them into the World Trade Center, so they knew this was a possibility. You know, knowing full well that, and the president was notified on the 6th of August, that the terrorists were planning on hijacking our planes, you would think that he would have notified the airlines, he would have put the, you know, a security out, they would have been checking Arabs and Middle Easterners getting onto our planes very carefully. They might have even armed the pilots, reinforced the doors, and certainly told the pilots under no circumstances to allow themselves to be hijacked. But they didn't do any of those things, did they?
Well, that is correct. Let me give you a little rundown on the culture that's throughout government. Now, first of all, there's no talk about this whatsoever. The success of 19 hijackers, or the blame for their success, is primarily some type of problems in the FAA, and of course that's what I write about, because I was a key FAA inspector. We've had hijackings for 40 years. Inspectors, like including myself, have made reports on how easy it was to prevent them, and the question is, why wasn't it done? And then when I go and I report these things, and I'm talking about hardcore corruption now within the government's aviation safety offices. When I report it to members of Congress and they sympathize, but they say, "Wait, hey, this isn't our area of responsibility." When I go to the Justice Department, when I file federal actions to report these things, and there's two particular federal statutes that permit that, we obviously have some serious problems. Now, going to what you just said about all the early warnings we had of planes being hijacked, if this here, it's a combination of incompetence also in the FAA, but within 24 hours, the two basic things to prevent hijackings could have been put in place. And the FAA had plenty of warning. And those two things are the first, and that's probably how the hijackers got into the cockpit. The flight attendants have keys, and almost any able-bodied male can get the keys from the flight attendants. So my recommendation years ago was no keys in the cabin. And then the second thing, keep the see that the cockpit door isn't open while there's passengers on board. But right now all the attention is on intelligence failures. It's like you and I, we don't lock our doors at night, we don't lock our automobile. We're counting on someone to tell us there's going to be some crime committed, and that's what the government is county is putting the blame on, and that way you can't go after anybody.
Well, now, of course, isn't there some protection for our nation's capital if you know that there is a terrorist or somebody has already crashed a couple of planes into the World Trade Center? Wouldn't you think they would have fighter planes guarding our nation's capital?
Well, of course, now they do.
But why didn't they beforehand? That's the question.
Well, first of all, we weren't mentally thinking of killing a plane full of our own passengers before, and I'm still not approving of that. I wouldn't want to be in a plane with a load of passengers, and because someone on the ground, and we got some pretty big jerks in government. You know, one of those thinks we're hijacked, thinks we may go into a big building, so they'll kill us all.
Well, but don't you think that it would be logical at least to have the planes in the air? Maybe you might be able to head them off. You could buzz them. Why would we have absolutely no planes in the air at all when we know that two planes have been hijacked already And, of course, another plane is heading towards the nation's capital and allowed to, fly circles around Washington, D.C. You mean we have absolutely no protection for our nation's capital?
Well, they did alert fighter planes, and they eventually did take off.
Well, they got there 12 minutes afterwards. They had an hour and 40 minutes to be in the air from the time the first plane was hijacked. And there were no planes in the air for an hour and 40 minutes. How could that be, Rodney?
Well, first of all, when the controller sees this problem, he doesn't really know what's going on since there's no communication. And let me mention, I had an emergency once taken off out of Honolulu in a Boeing Stratocruiser. And I just broke ground and an engine failed, and we weren't climbing at all, so we had to immediately dump fuel. Well, while you're dumping fuel, you don't talk to the controller. So the controller's calling us. We're ignoring him while we're dumping fuel. Well, the controller would not know what type of emergency the planes had, at least for a while there. So I can, it took a while for the controller to realize, hey, something's not quite right here.
An hour and 40 minutes from the time the first plane was hijacked until the last plane crashed into the Pentagon, and they didn't have any idea. And they were on maximum alert knowing that there was going to be a major attack on America. You would think that they would have told somebody. And why is it that the government won't allow anybody to talk to those air controllers or have ordered them not to talk to anybody?
Well, I don't know where I'd get much out of control. Again, remember there's a time lapse. Yeah, because they eventually then decide, hey, we do have a problem here. But, you know, I was in the Navy a year before Pearl Harbor, and this is a culture in the United States. We had, and I could see, even as a young kid, I could see, hey, we should be taking more preventative measures here. But anyhow, one of the radar operators saw a fleet of Japanese planes coming in from the northwest. That didn't alert anybody. We sank a sub a few hours before the attack. That didn't alert anybody. This is the culture in the United States, and we won't admit it, that we got internal problems. And the same thing with 9/11. I'm an insider. I had one of the key positions in the FAA in the most crash-plagued airline in the nation's history. And here I've got several dozen CIA, FBI, and other agents feeding me information. I'm sending letters to members of Congress. Like, for instance, I about 7 months before TWA went down, I'm sending a three-page letter to every member of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees warning them of surface-to-air missile attacks.
Now you're talking about TW-800 that went down in 1996.
Yes, off of Long Island.
Right.
And would you believe not a single one responded? So, again, we've got serious problems. And, of course, it's standard in the United States to cover up.
Well, I think, but Rodney, the thing is that there were over 200 people who saw the missiles go up in the air, and the government denied anybody saw missiles. The government agents got up before the NTSB and actually lied about what the witnesses had said. And they quoted witnesses, and of course we have this wonderful film called Silence, and you'll actually see the fellow from the NTSB at these hearings saying what the witnesses said, and then you'll hear the witnesses. They simply lied about the whole thing. It was all a cover-up. Obviously, there were missiles that brought the plane down. And yet, of course, they are still trying to tell the American people it was an explosion in the central fuel tank.
Yeah, and that's in the book, Defrauding America, I go into details on that and to show the deception by the CIA and the FBI. You know, when I was in the FAA, I accused the NTSB of covering up major safety problems and major corruption within the FAA. And then I even took the NTSB, I filed a federal lawsuit in San Francisco against the NTSB on their cover-up tactics. And so what happened on the cover-up on TWA Flight 800, that's in character. But then there's another cover-up right after that, shortly after 9/11, and that was the American Airlines flight that went down shortly after takeoff. And there's at least a couple of dozen people, including retired policemen, retired firemen, who saw flames coming out of the aircraft toward the rear of the aircraft. Now, the NTSB is not paying any attention to that. And there's possibly two reasons for NTSB cover-up. Well, maybe more than two. One, when there's a scandal, the way our government works, if the scandal is in government, you circle the wagons and everybody covers up. Well, now, on TWA Flight 100, I could think of a couple of reasons why the cover-up. One, here I am. I'm writing all these letters to members of Congress warning the surface-to-air missile attacks and urging them to immediately contact me and my CIA source. Here they don't respond, and a few months later we have a missile taken down, TWA-800.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit of background? How did you know about the surface-to-air missiles that have been brought into the United States, and of course, what happened to the CIA agent who told you about them?
Well, here's what happened. General Dostum, this is in 1995 now. General Dostum, from one of the Afghan warlords, he was in negotiations. Negotiations occurred in Los Angeles, and one of the people involved in it was a former head of a secret CIA operation based in Honolulu, and that's Ron Rewald. Rewald, since he knew some of the Afghan rebels, he was brought into the negotiations, and Dostum offered to give as many as 100 Stinger missiles to the United States at no charge. And at the same time, terrorists were bidding on these missiles. So if the United States did not accept them, then they would fall into the hands of terrorists. Well, the FBI and the CIA Los Angeles turned them down. Rewald was angry. He turned over documentation and details to me, and that's why I wrote the letter.
All right. First of all, the CIA and the FBI would not go along with the demands of the Afghan general, who wanted to have somebody here in the United States who had been arrested on drug charges set free. In other words, he was going to give 100 Stinger missiles, the surface-to-air missiles which had been so effective against the Soviets. He was willing to give those 100 of them back to us so they wouldn't fall into terrorist hands. And, of course, who was the man he wanted released?
I don't remember his name, but he was one of the people working under General Dostum.
All right, fine. And, of course, he had been arrested in this country on drug charges?
Yes, and he was at Terminal Island. So all Dostum wanted was this guy released, and then he would release the surface-to-air missiles.
Now, were any of the surface-to-air missiles, had they been smuggled into the United States, or they were under General Dostum's control at that time then?
Well, Dostum had them because he furnished serial numbers of about a dozen of them just to prove that, yes, he did have missiles.
All right, so we turned him down, and you assume then that they went to the terrorists at that time. Is that right?
That's right. Now, whether any of those shot down TWA, that I don't know. But the public might be outraged if they knew this, And then here we have a plane shot down with a missile shortly thereafter.
All right. Now, the other thing is, what about Ron Riewald? He was sent to jail. Was he sent to jail before or after he gave you the information?
That was before, and then he got out.
Well, then, of course, so why did they, after the CIA had betrayed him and sent him to prison on trumped-up charges, why would they call him in on a project such as this? Was he still affiliated with the CIA after they sent him to prison?
No, he wasn't affiliated with them anymore, but he knew some of the Afghan rebels, and this is how he got involved in it, because... As I think back now, Riewald was in prison at that time, at the time these negotiations took place.
All right.
And that's how we got to know one of the Afghan rebels. And then he also knew some others from in the past.
All right, now, for our listeners out there who don't know who Ron Riewald was, he headed a CIA bank in Hawaii. Basically, the CIA is a government within itself. It has banks, it has airlines, it has all sorts of corporations. It's the biggest drug smuggler in the world today. And, of course, it works hand in glove with terrorist organizations and the mafia. But Ron Riewald was, of course, in charge of this CIA bank in Hawaii. And when it became obvious it was a CIA bank, why he was simply set up and sent off to prison. What were they going to do, send him to prison for 50 years or something?
Well, it was, I think, even longer than that. What happened is when the cover was blown on his operation by a Honolulu television reporter, the CIA took all the money out of the bank, and then they had the Justice Department charge Riewald with embezzling the funds. And so the judge in the case, who was that famous San Francisco attorney again? Belli. Belli wanted to represent Riewald, and the judge refused and appointed a young kid who just got out of law school who never tried a case before. And then a lot of the CIA documents Riewald wanted to introduce, the judge would not allow that. So you end up with a naive jury who believes everything the prosecutor says, and so Riewald was found guilty and sentenced to it's many years. I think it was even more than 50 years, but let's say 50 years. But what I did when he was coming up for a parole hearing, I submitted a draft of a book I was writing that had Riewald in it. I don't know if it had anything to do with his release, but he was released then shortly thereafter.
Of course, this is what they do with CIA agents. They simply use them and then they destroy them. And you know quite a few CIA agents who are in jail because they wanted to do the right thing or tried to get the truth out about the CIA's criminal activities?
Yeah, well, you know, the way... Like what you mentioned a little while ago about the CIA drug smuggling into the United States, which has been going on for about 50 years. Well, the way this is kept from the American public is, first of all, any insiders who are about to talk, we simply charge them with file false charges against them, and they end up in prison. And then you have enough control over the media and to where the public doesn't know about it. Well, these are not only criminal acts, they're subversive activities against the American public. And how something like that can go on for 50 years and the public not know about it, somebody in history is going to write about the naive American public someday.
Well, actually, Monica Jensen Stevenson did write about this whole thing in her book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And, of course, all copies were called back from the bookstores. Of course, she couldn't get the copies. She went to Canada. The publisher up there printed 5 or 10,000 copies of her book. Suddenly that publisher went bankrupt, bought by another publisher, and they shredded 10,000 copies of Monica's book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And of course they said, oh, it was a terrible mistake, but they've never republished it. There's all sorts of demands for that book, and it goes into great detail about the CIA and drugs, and ties it into, of course, the abandonment of our boys in Vietnam. They don't want the American people to know that the CIA has been smuggling drugs all this time. And that's why they had to suppress that book and Monica's second book, Spite House.
You know, it's amazing that here we put men and women, tens of thousands of them, in prison for peanut quantities of or drugs, or no drugs at all, simply because someone says, hey, that person had drugs in their possession. So with no evidence other than someone who was being paid in one way or the other for his perjured testimony, they end up in prison, and then you've got the CIA, and you even had the White House involved in the drug smuggling during the Contra affair. And those crimes are far worse than the offenses almost any federal prisoner has committed.
And if anybody wants to, of course, Gary Webb has an excellent book, Dark Alliance. And you have an excellent book. It's called Drugging America. And Rodney actually published that. And he has Defrauding America, Drugging America. He has his book, The Friendly Skies. We actually carry all of these books. We think they're important, especially the one on drugging America. Can you imagine the CIA being involved in this, and they're able to cover that up from the American people year after year, decade after decade?
One advantage of being on this earth as long as I have, and, you know, being in the Navy a year before Pearl Harbor, I've been around a while, but I've seen the lying among America's leaders starting up, and I write about it in some of my first books going back to 1978. But the lying now is so extensive. It's so advanced. I was even growing up while Hitler was had his spiel of you repeat a lie often enough and the public believes it. Well, I think we're doing better than Hitler.
Oh, I have no question at all. In fact, I think that Hitler and Goebbels would be green with envy if they could see the degree of control that exists over what the American people think. And the American people don't even understand that the media is controlled. That's the amazing thing.
Well, you know, I guess it's a combination of, one, the cover-up by the media and members of Congress cover up for this all these criminal activities, and then the American public. I don't know why, because the books are very interesting, really written by insiders. But it seems to me, the average male, what's he interested in? The ball games, and then the average, take another group, the grandkids. And here we've got all of these, like in Vietnam, we lost 58,000 men were killed on some screwball theory, and we've got, and this is even worse what's being done now, where Bush is making all these statements about the Iraq has this, Iraq has that. There's not a shred of evidence, but he keeps repeating it. And, of course, he's got the mouthpieces, Condoleezza Rice and Rumsfeld, and they all repeat it. And you've got the most of the media. They're following the pack.
You know,
they're saying the same thing, and there's not a bit of proof supporting any of it.
You know, it's so interesting you mentioned that, Rodney. I remember when they were saying bin Laden was behind the attack on the World Trade Center. But they had proof of it, but they couldn't let anybody see it. And they kept saying, we have proof of it, but we don't let them see it. And then, you know, a couple of months later, somebody came up with this video, and you couldn't really tell if it was Osama or not, but they told you it was Osama. And then, of course, it was all in Arabic, so they told you what he was saying, And, of course, I know heard people who could speak Arabic saying they listened to the tape. They couldn't figure out what he was saying. And so how could they, how did the CIA know? But they flashed it up on the screen. In other words, he heard the Arabic, they flashed it on the screen, and they said, that's what Osama is saying, and that's the smoking gun. If that was the smoking gun, if that's all they really had on Osama bin Laden, then somebody ought to be tried for an unnecessary war in Afghanistan. After all, it was Saudi citizens that attacked our building. Saudis financed them. Maybe we went to war with the wrong country. We'll be right back here on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there in the listening audience and you're concerned about what's going on, we hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com and pull down our newsletters, and maybe you'll like a free copy of one of our newsletters, the September newsletter. It deals with the September attack a year ago. October newsletter is Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the House Select Committee on Intelligence, Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Our November newsletter deals with the coming financial crisis. We'd be glad to send you any one of the newsletters free of charge. If you haven't had a newsletter before, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope that some of you will want to partner with us and join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day. And, of course, you call that same 1-800-5-HIV-WAR number if you're interested. If you're interested in learning more about Rodney's books, certainly Defrauding America, Drugging America is one of my favorites, certainly the Friendly Skies, and you'd like more information on that, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and they can just give you more information on the books. I think all of these things are important. You need to get the information. You need to help us get it out across America. But if the Central Intelligence Agency really is involved in assassinating people, if the Central Intelligence Agency was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy, if it's really pushing drugs, is there any reason to think that perhaps, just perhaps, somehow, they may have known about what happened on September 11th beforehand and intentionally did nothing? Because we know, at least according to Kristen Breitweiser, that within two hours of the attack, according to the New York Times, FBI agents were at the homes and the restaurants and the flight schools and the neighborhoods of the men, the hijackers. Gee, how did they know? How did they know so soon when they had no idea what was going to happen? It was all just a surprise. Well, I think that there's a lot of questions out there, and obviously we're never going to get to the bottom of it because President Bush has actually said that, he is going to have to appoint the chairman of the committee. Do you think that we can have the president's appointee will investigate to see what the president really knew? And in other words, it's all a cover-up. It's like deja vu all over again. We'll be right back here with Rodney Stitch. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Rodney Stitch. And, of course, Rodney has been writing books and gathering information. And, of course, he has a number of people who've been with the CIA and the FBI and the DEA, and they've come to him and they've told him about the CIA drug smuggling operations. And we, of course, have a number of our own sources on this. But Rodney's book, The Drugging of America, and here you're these men, who've been sent to prison not because they committed a crime, but because they wanted to report a crime. And that's, of course, the tragic thing. We can't let the American people learn the truth, or they would cease to believe the leaders who are moving us ever closer towards war in the Middle East and the New World Order and, of course, ever-increasing government control over our lives. We want to keep the people fat, dumb, and happy, just like the cattle just before they're led down the slot to their final demise. Well, Rodney, of course, as you talk to these people in jail, are any of these CIA or FBI or DEA agents getting out of prison at all? Or are they just going to keep them there indefinitely to keep them silent?
Well, some of them do get out, and some of them that while they were in gave me a lot of information. Once they get out, at least some of them, they disappear. And I guess they've been warned if they provide me with any more information that they'll end up back in prison.
Well, I know this to be a fact. I know a very a man who was actually sent to prison. He was with the John Birch Society. He was sent to prison on jumped-up charges twice, and then he was told if he ever spoke again publicly, he would never get out of prison. And he lives in constant fear now, totally destroyed, you know. And, of course, when they can do that, why, of course, it gives you an idea of the lengths that they'll go to silence and intimidate and destroy people who are trying to tell the American people the truth.
If the public knew how easy it was to be set up and end up in prison, and it happens to so many people, and I describe it in detail in all my books, and I know what it's like because they came after me. And when they first started coming after me, now I had a lot of real estate. Ten years ago, I had $10 million in real estate, of which 60% was equity. And this is what I was using to fund my exposure activities. Because, you know, writing books, traveling all over the country, giving speeches and appearing on radio and TV, that takes money. And book sales don't provide the money. Maybe if I wrote something important like the Harry Potter book but that the public seemed to prefer, maybe it would be profitable. But so they came after me with the most bizarre scheme, and it was a CIA front law firm in San Francisco, and then all of the protections in law, they were denied to me, and both in the California courts and then in the federal courts, and eventually they stripped me of everything. So they figure, well, that will keep this guy quiet. But it's so easy to do. And I talk to so many people who have lost everything that they had on trumped-up charges.
Well, of course, you cannot have a free society when you have a rogue organization like the Central Intelligence Agency and even the FBI. I mean, the FBI is working, has agents are working with the mafia. And, of course, the FBI has sent innocent people to prison, and they knew they were innocent people. And, of course, if you haven't read the book, certainly A Deadly Deception, story of how the FBI works with the mafia, or Double Cross, how the CIA works with the mafia. And this will just overlap exactly what Rodney is saying. And, you know, you need to understand that we're living in a fallen world, and evil really is working at the upper echelons of our society.
No, the a good support for what you said is occurred in Boston, and this is well established both by the Boston newspapers and in a criminal trial that terminated not too long ago. But for over 20 years, FBI agents were working with organized crime, the Winter Hill Gang.
Whitey Bulger was the head of that.
Bulger, yes.
Right.
And even providing this organized crime group with the names of informants who were coming to the FBI. So, and the FBI agents knew what would happen next. The informants were murdered.
And many times tortured before they were murdered. And, of course, any time the local police tried to do anything, why the FBI would intervene to keep Whitey Bulger and his buddy out of prison. And they knew they were murderers, and they continued murdering, and they allowed them to.
And this was known to J. Edgar Hoover. This came out during the criminal trial against a couple of the FBI agents. So here, Hoover knew this was going on and didn't stop it. Well, now, and something else, and this is in a new book I'm writing, which is available on the Internet for downloading. I have another source who was a member of the Bonanno crime family in New York, and he's provided me details of how The same thing was going on in the New York office. FBI agents were providing his group with the names of informants, and the informants would then be murdered. And so this is not an isolated case. And when the FBI will do this, and as you say, now in the Boston situation, three men were charged with murder. They went to prison. Two of them died in prison, and the FBI knew that they were innocent and that one of their informants killed the individual for which the three people were sent to prison. I think Bush, when he says the reason the terrorists hate us so much is because we're so good, and I could just about erp when I heard that.
Well, I think that, of course, I won't get into what I feel about that. Certainly, they're not telling the American people the truth. The reason that the Islamists hate us is because we are over there maintaining all these tyrannical governments in power, and they are not allowing the Islamic people the opportunity to choose their own leaders. They hate us because we have our troops stationed on their holy ground there in Saudi Arabia. Because we're keeping the corrupt Saudi government in power, the corrupt Musharraf in power in Pakistan, certainly the corrupt government in place in Algeria and in Egypt. And of course, we actually brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power in Iran by toppling the Shah. And we could go on and on and on and on. We finance the Israelis, and we finance Arafat. We finance both sides. And then we wonder why there's problems over there.
Well, you know, when I used to, I lived in the Middle East for a while. This is many years ago. I lived in Ramallah and Jerusalem, and I flew into Baghdad and all those places over there. I was flying Muslim pilgrims to Mecca and Medina for a couple of years, and I was visiting Palestinian refugee camps. At that time, the people liked us, but the problem is in the occupied territory, and Israel's not going to give those up, and we're paying the price for it.
Well, I think that, you know, everything is being done to maintain problems. In other words, supposedly Israelis were going to turn the property, a lot of the property, the West Bank, over to the Palestinians, and then they insisted that their settlements stay there. And they built those settlements so they would always be a festering sore as far as the Palestinians are concerned, because they really don't want a solution. They just want the problem.
Well, that's right. And I notice a number of these Jewish commentators, I mean, they're just egging us on. Hey, we got to invade Iraq. And when we do, we've got Muslims all over the world willing to die to kill Americans. And we've already got so much hatred against us. We've got more people who hate us than people hated Hitler. And I'm not saying this to praise Hitler, by no means. But we've got more people throughout the world hating us than they hated Hitler.
You know, Chris, you know, we're alienating all of our former allies in Europe. This idea that we're going to go ahead and we don't care what anybody says and we don't care what the United Nations says, we're going to go ahead and take out the wicked Saddam Hussein. And, of course, he is a wicked man. But there are a lot of wicked men in the world. There's Mugabe in Rhodesia now, who's starving to death half of his population. Are we going to worry about Mugabe? Are we going to worry about the wicked people in the Congo and in Africa? Or are we going to worry about the wicked Chinese communist dictators who are persecuting Christians over there and enslaving their people and having them work for a dollar a day, you know, in the slave labor camps, shops to supply goods for the American population so we can buy them at Walmart, cheapest goods in the world. Things are never as they appear to be, and I think the American people have to understand that, as I've said so often, and I will say again, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if we aren't willing to take a stand at this time, when? And, of course, will we be judged for what, not only what we've done, but what we haven't done in times like these? And so, well, if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Rodney, what do you think is going to happen with this war with Iraq? Because there's no question that it doesn't matter whether it's Saddam who has weapons of mass destruction or not. We're intent on going to war over there.
Oh, young Bush is definitely determined to do that. You know, in the book, Defraud in America, I go into details as to how George Bush Sr., when he was president, was involved in secretly funding Iraq's military buildup through the agricultural guarantee program. And
this is before Desert Storm. In other words, we
yes,
gave him the weapons
in the
80s. So, right, we gave
right
him the weapons
right up to about 2 months before Iraq invaded Kuwait. And they probably couldn't have done that if the United States hadn't not only funded them, but I go into details to show how the United States made it possible for Iraq to get these cluster bombs, how chemical weapons and all, they were receiving help and developing chemical weapons. And this is very detailed. And there's a book that really goes into it called The Spider Web. And this is how the United States secretly armed Iraq. And it's an ugly story. And if the public knew this, so what we're doing is getting the rebound from that.
Or sometimes they refer to the blowback. Who wrote Spider
Blowback,
Web?
I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
I know you did. But there's a book out by that title, and it's a very good book. Who wrote The Spider Web?
Oh, it was someone from England, from Great Britain, that wrote it. And it's quite a book.
How long has it been out?
Oh, I think it was published, I think, in about 1992 or 1993.
Well, I have no question at all that we armed Saddam Hussein. Not only did he get the agricultural loans, some little bank down in the south, the southern part of the United States, lent him $5 billion. This is just a little branch of an Italian bank, $5 billion. And of course, it's very obvious that that somebody told the bank manager what to do, and he kept saying, "No, it was all my idea. I was going to lend him $5 billion," and the judge says, "I don't believe you. Who gave you orders?" We have this article from the New York Times, and fella obviously was afraid for his own life and the life of his family, and he said, "No, I did this all on my own. Please, believe me, I did it all on my own." $5 billion to Saddam Hussein, within the year or so of the attack, and then of course all this money for the agricultural loans—that was another $5 billion, wasn't it, Rodney?
Yes, billions of dollars. Just so the listeners know, we're talking about billions, B as in boy, and these funds were guaranteed by the American taxpayers, and you are paying for them. And all the interest, and then now you're going to pay to take care of the blowback. Hey, boy, this is a fabulous game, and I wonder how many Americans are going to get killed in the process.
Well, we create always the best enemies our own tax money can buy. We're building up, of course, communist China for the coming war. We're building up Russia for the coming war, and always finding some means of giving them more money. Oh, they don't have enough money to deactivate their nuclear missiles that have to be deactivated, and so we give them money for that, and we give them money to give to the Army, so the Army will be having money, and we give them money to employ their nuclear scientists and their biological scientists and their chemical scientists so they don't go to work for the wicked Saddam Hussein. We can always figure another justification for giving more money in between that and our corporations going in there. Once again, we're creating the best enemy our money can buy.
Now, one of the things I'm waiting for next is, and I go into details in Defrauding America on the latest edition, and this is how suitcase nuclear bombs have been smuggled out of Russia through Lithuania, and how this one insider, and I go into details on him, how he discovered this. And he also discovered from his Russian sources that the CIA and the FBI had moles. This is before Hansen was discovered. But anyhow, the Justice Department goes after him, files sham charges against him, and he ends up in prison for a while. But anyhow, these suitcase nuclear bombs, I expect them to start going off in the United States sometime in the future.
Well, I think, of course, that they can justify that anytime they want to. You know, they can always blame it on Saddam Hussein, the wicked Saddam Hussein, no matter who is responsible for them.
Well, that's right, and I think one of the things, if we were to invade Iraq, and we've got worldwide hatred against us, I would think the suitcase nuclear bombs, and then Stinger missiles bringing down airliners. Imagine, I mean, all the things they can do to us, and nobody's giving a bit of thought to why are they so mad at us.
Well, that's because we're free. We're a democracy. That's why they're mad at us. At least that's what George Bush keeps saying. I wonder if anybody out there really believes what they say. Oh, they don't like us because we're free here and we have a democracy.
Oh, that's a lot of...
Oh, I know. You know, I'll have to say I get a little nauseated every time I hear that. And then I hear other so-called responsible Christian conservative leaders saying exactly the same thing. That's the most ridiculous thing in the world.
You wonder now, can they be that stupid, or is there some powerful force that's causing all of these, many people in the media supporting all of these lies that are coming out of the mouth of Bush and his gang?
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things, Rodney, is I've read the Washington Post. Now, there's no more establishment left-wing publication than the Washington Post. And about 2 weeks ago, they were saying, we've misjudged George Bush. I mean, he may not be able to pronounce words very well, but, you know, he's looking more and more like Ronald Reagan, another man being misjudged.
Jesus.
And a really true leader. He's doing such a great job. And, you know, and I'm reading and I'm saying the Washington Post is endorsing and saying what a great job George Bush is doing. Heaven help us. God help us.
I know it. And this is what I can't comprehend. What's behind it? I mean, before he got in, he reminded me of a suede shoe salesman. And now I'm of course, convinced of it. But what gets me is that people are swallowing it.
Well, the thing is, of course, he has the control of it. He has the support of the media. He has a very good speechwriter. But even more than that, of course, he is not of the president. He is simply a figurehead for other people like Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice. And I think that, of course, he is really simply carrying out the programs that his father put in motion and were continued by Bill Clinton. And now, of course, they're being continued by young George Bush.
Yeah, you know, I think of all the dumb statements. I remember the very first one I can remember is when he made that statement about the reason the terrorists hate us is because we're so good. And then the next stupid statement, as he's encouraging people to fly again, he's authorizing military planes to shoot down airliners. Then the next thing was he's going to fund a program to alter existing airliners to where the pilots lose control and the control will revert to someone on the ground. Well, first of all, if the jet age will be over before that could be accomplished, and I, as a pilot, would hate to lose all control of the aircraft and have someone on the ground handling it.
Especially if his name is Osama.
If
we could take control, what would make people think that the Osama couldn't take control?
It's and then all of these positive statements, it's like some college kid up, maybe I better go down a lower level, some high school kid rambling on, and there's no proof to anything. Some of the statements are utterly stupid. And everybody thinks he's some guru with decades of experience. And here he and Condoleezza Rice, National Security advisor. They don't have any experience, but they're good when it comes to a lot of bull, as long as you don't check the accuracy of what they're saying.
Well, I think that really you find that the liberal media is building up Condoleezza Rice. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She worked for Chevron before she got her job. And, of course, Cheney worked for Halliburton, deeply involved in the oil industry. Rumsfeld is, was around 25 years ago. They brought him back in. You know, the interesting thing is they really don't have very many people. They had to go to Kissinger to hopefully head the congressional committee to investigate the 9/11. Of course, he's resigned. He's not going to do it because he's not about to give up his list of clients. I would find probably most of them, or many of them, of course, are coming from a subversive point of view. He's not about to release all this. But the fact that George Bush would have to go to Henry Kissinger means they don't have very many people. They just have to keep rotating them back and forth again and again and again.
If I was a young person, I would be fearful for my future, but hopefully it'll occur after I'm no longer around.
Well, I think that the thing is, Rodney, that it's your job and my job. We're both old enough to know what's going on, and we have to just keep trying to reach people any way we can. And you write your books, and you get on the radio, and I always enjoy having you on to our programs. We're just about out of time. What's your parting thought for our listeners this evening?
Well, to get more information about what we've been talking about, go to the website, defraudingamerica.com, and you'll see letters there. You'll see copies of lawsuits that I filed that have national significance, and you'll get quite an education.
That's defraudingamerica.com, right?
Right.
God bless you for everything you do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. As a guest this evening has been Rodney Stitch, and he's a very, very courageous person who is willing to sacrifice everything for America. And the question I was asked is, what are you willing to sacrifice to preserve this wonderful heritage of freedom that we have inherited from generations past? Do you care about the future? Do you care about your children and your grandchildren? Are you willing to let America be lost? Well, if you really want to join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival for our leaders and our ministers. Lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be back with you. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
down here and win. Anything interesting?
Another
Monopoly
game.
Really? Well, that's two today.
Yeah, we sold quite a few.